anything. Hugh grinned at me. It was inevitable, though, sooner or later, and it isn't relevant to this project anyway. So why are you helping? Now it was Hugh's turn to shrug. Honestly, I just think that Topopolis is interesting. And we've just brought some new neural net designs online, which we need to stress test. The information processing requirements on your project will make good test cases, so win-win. Fair enough. I cocked my head at Hugh, inviting him to continue or volunteer more commentary. However, he seemed to be done. I gestured to the next person and grimaced. This is Locutus. Seriously? Garfield said in an incredulous tone. Hey, I'd have preferred Hugh, but it appears to be taken, said Locutus. I eyed him. His getup was generally Borg-like, but there was a lot more armor than I remembered from the TNG episodes. I pointed and said, Are you sure you've got the theme right? Locutus flexed, moving the shoulder pads. Steampunk influence. We're kind of evolving, you know? Gar rolled his eyes. Oh, jeez. Anyway, I said to the group, Locutus and company are part of the design team for the Boojum androids. They're going to be working on the low-level stuff first. Autonomous systems, muscle placement and control, and so forth. Which also means they'll need some in-close SUDAR scans of the natives with a lot more detail than we have so far. Action shots would be good too, Locutus said. We want to get the proper walking, running, and swimming mechanics. Imagine putting together a beaver mock-up that bounces around like an otter. Probably wouldn't fool anyone. My chuckle was echoed around the table. We can probably get video clips from the spy drones for that side of things, which is good because we've already got a lot of demands on our SUDAR scanning schedule. Hugh, how are things going with the vibrating windows idea? Not great. There aren't that many locations where conditions are clean enough for us to be able to pick up usable sounds. The snarks appear to be garrulous in large groups, but much less so in smaller groups. It's like they egg each other on. Unfortunately, large groups make it too hard to isolate anything. Plus, it turns out glass isn't as common as we might have expected. Controlled environment, Bill said. They aren't really outdoors as such, plus having a coat of fur would make them less concerned about temperature swings. Hugh considered for a moment. Speculative, but not unreasonable. I took a close look at some scans as well. It looks like they use oiled paper for window coverings. Way easier to make, but totally unsuitable for what we were attempting. All of which means we'll have to depend on spy drones more than expected. Locutus held up a hand. Hey, listen, what would help us a lot is some input from a biologist, especially one with anatomical expertise. I wasn't sure if I should bring it up, but Bridget, it would be handy. I know she's a little skittish around large groups of bobs, but I sighed. I'll talk to her, Locutus. Anything else? Will waved his hand. I have a line on a guy who was an expert on megastructures. I'll set up an appointment to talk with him. Was? Well, he's dead. I gave Will the side eye. Wait. He's a replicant? Yep. Retired to the Vulcan post-life arcology in the Omicron Squared Eridani system. Apparently he turned right around and started lecturing at the university again via Manny, so I have to fit myself into his schedule. Whatever works. I looked around the room. Anything else that needs to be covered? There were several shakes of heads, but no responses. Great, I'll call another general meeting if necessary, but for the most part you can all follow your own schedules. Thanks all. Within a few milliseconds everyone had popped out, leaving only Bill. With the load off the VR system, I reactivated Jeeves and accepted a coffee. So what's up? Bridget. Bill hesitated. Locutus was right to ask about her for consulting, but I want to take it one step further. I'd like to see her on the expedition itself. I frowned. She's got children, Bill. And Howard. I don't know how well that would work. She'd have to be away from them for large periods of time. Granted, but they might be able to work something out, or she might clone. Doubtful. Yeah, I guess. But let's not write off the idea without trying, okay? At least bring it up. I nodded. Will do. 10. Things are coming together. Herschel, September 2333, Interstellar Space. I sat back in my chair, laced my fingers together, and grinned at Neil. I do love it when a plan comes together. Plan my hairy white butt. We floated an idea and got bites. It would seem a lot of people on Romulus do not like the political climate. Hardly surprising, Hirsch. Faith never completely went away, even if they suffered some PR setbacks. They're still trying to take over, still trying to drive policy, and still messing things up. So, what's the count? Well, someone started a society. I paused to reread the email. Ever Onward, they call it, very high-sounding. They have something like 15,000 members. All willing to climb aboard and start a new colony somewhere far away? That's the theory. I'm sure a lot of them are just playing at it or joining up as a form of protest vote. Are you sure you want to go this way, Hirsch? Neil was frowning, and his tone was more serious than usual. I decided I should pay attention. Come on, Neil. We've had lots of conversations about the way things have stalled. You've agreed with me. Wait, I've agreed with you? When did you become the mastermind? Not important. The point is, we agree the Bobs seem to have turned to various forms of navel-gazing. Gamers, skippies, even Will with his Valhalla terraforming, they've become like old men with their stamp collecting. There are still Bobs heading outward. Phineas, Ferb, Icarus, and Daedalus. They're running away as much as anything. I tell you, buddy, something is going on that's not healthy. So you've changed your mind about this? No, I think I maybe want to expand it some. Do more than just ferry another batch of humans to another planet. Like, we've got this crap ton of refined material from the PAV deal, so we don't have to stop for a long, long time. Set up enough manufacturing internally so we can crank out Heaven vessels assembly line style, populate them with AMIs like they did in the battle for Terra, and squirt them out at every system we pass by. And remote control them? Yeah, Neil, it's called delegation, or laziness. What about the colony? If we're sending the AMI-controlled vessels ahead of us, we'll know if a system has a viable candidate planet and we can stop and set up. Then continue on sounds a lot like Ick and Day. At least we'll be doing something. I'm tired of being a museum piece. It's not the most terrible idea you've ever had. Let's talk to the Ever Onward people. I nodded to Neil and started composing an email. For the first time in a long, long time, I was beginning to feel excited again. 11. Breaking In. Bob, October 2333, outskirts Eta Leporis. No plan ever survives contact with the enemy. Okay, the Snarks weren't the enemy as such, but they were the opponent in the scenario we were executing, and the viewer count on our remote feed probably included half the Bobiverse currently in range of Bobnet. There's a gaggle of Boojums heading for the entrance, Bill said. Should it be gaggle? Someone asked over the intercom channel. How about murder? How is that better? Crows or geese? Either way. The argument went viral, and soon there was an actual discussion channel dedicated to the question of what unit would be used to describe a gathering of boojums. Or maybe booja. The question of plurals had a side discussion of its own going. I shook my head in disbelief and chuckled. Replicative drift or not, original Bob was still very much alive in this gaggle of post-singularity replicants. Or maybe herd. Pack. While the name-obsessed discussion spiraled into ever more esoteric suggestions, Bill announced into the intercom, Ballistic trajectory set, we should be able to drift right in and settle on a couple of them with minimal vector adjustment. Assuming they don't pick today to change things up just for fun. I'm pretty sure those are some equivalent of AMIs, Bill replied. They've shown no variability at all, strictly script-driven. There was a moment of silence as the cloaked drones approached within a dozen yards of the Boojums. Even the name obsession discussion petered out. The drones drifted in the last few yards, made a minute adjustment, and contact. The non-streamlined design of the Boojums allowed the much smaller drones to settle inside the Boojums' skeletal frames so that they didn't stick out. If there was some kind of automated security, it was highly likely that silhouette matching would form part of the strategy. "Well, we appear to have been successful," Bill said. "Any traffic?" Will asked. I turned at the voice. I hadn't sensed Will's arrival. Then I remembered I was in the Moot VR and didn't own the monitoring channel. "Just radio." I pointed at the section of the data window that indicated radio traffic. "Packetized and either compressed or encrypted, or both. We've tentatively identified envelope and control fields, but we don't have enough context yet to spoof them, even assuming we could come up with a legitimate-looking addressing and data payload." "But no scut?" "Nada." I shook my head. We had gotten used to everyone on Earth having the same technology, but who knows how much of that was caused by the fact that everyone was sharing knowledge, or stealing it. I smiled and nodded to acknowledge the point. Sure, vehement and all that. But the others had stuff we didn't, and vice versa. And even with the Brazilians, that was true. They had the cloaking thing. I shrugged and let the silence hang for a moment. "Yes, and to my point, the Boojums seem to be following the same pattern, more advanced in some ways, less in others. I guess, in isolation, the tech tree development path isn't an inevitable march." "They're going in," Garfield said, interrupting our conversation. Sure enough, I'd gotten wrapped up in the discussion with Will and lost track of the main event. Wow. Senior moment. Given that it was a cylinder with a 56-mile radius, from close up the outer shell had the appearance of a flat wall. Directly ahead of the Boojums, a huge space dock stood open. Massive reinforced doors seemed to be there only for emergencies. We'd never seen them move since we began surveillance. The Boojums drifted in, small attitude jets giving occasional puffs as they corrected their individual vectors. Eventually, the crafts drifted into docking bays designed specifically for them. An army of small service bots stood ready to receive the arrivals. After much discussion and argument, we'd settled on winging it as a strategy. Not our finest moment, I felt. The best suggestion had been to bail the moment the Boojums docked before any detailed examination could start. We had a good idea of what we could expect from SUDAR scans, but there was still a large amount of risk. In these close quarters, the drones were visible, as in eyeball visible. Even with the camouflage technology to make them appear to be part of the larger structure of the Boojums. If some kind of maintenance bot decided to take a detailed look, our geese might be cooked. The space dock was long but didn't penetrate deeply into the outer shell. It contained a large number of Boojum docking bays, about a third of which appeared to be occupied. Other vessels of uncertain function filled differently configured bays. And in the middle of it all, small bots zipped along on unknown errands, mounted on some kind of track system attached to all available surfaces. The overall effect was of a kind of organized chaos. There were indications that this area was originally configured to support snarks as well. We could see sealed, windowed areas that were probably control centers for some kind of operational staff. And a couple of the unidentified vessel types appeared to have hatches and viewports. Scans, however, had not shown one single trace of life. This whole operation was running on automatic. The non-rotating outer shell was 100 yards thick, consisting mostly of some kind of friable material. It wasn't structural. It was intended to absorb meteor impacts and block radiation. But it had many embedded design details, like a rigid support frame and the docking bay for the Boojums. And the item we were most interested in, the vector-matching system for getting from the non-rotating outer shell to the swiftly rotating inner shell without being ground up like seeds in a pepper mill. Getting access to what we were calling the spin transfer system was our ultimate goal. It must have been an interesting engineering challenge for the builders, and the solution based on our SUDAR scans, was genius. An elevator shaft ran through the outer shell from the cargo bay to the inner surface. Maybe elevator wasn't the right word, since with no rotation there was no artificial gravity to worry about, but it was as good a label as any. Embedded in the inner surface of the outer shell was a magnetic rail system circling the gap between the inner and outer shell, with components attached to each shell. A container would run along the transport rail from the cargo bay, then transfer to the vector matching system and accelerate to match velocity with the rotating inner shell. At that point, the container would be handed off from the outer shell to the inner, after which it would dock at one of four stations spaced equidistantly around the circumference of the inner shell. Well, that was the theory. We hadn't seen a single container actually make the trip on any of the entrance assemblies that we'd been surveilling. As near as we could tell, the containers were all docked at the base of the transport rail. The Boojums didn't need to go inside, and apparently nothing inside needed to come out. The Boojums settled onto their assigned racks, and maintenance bots moved forward to perform oil changes or whatever they did. Our drones detached from the Boojums, staying as close as possible to avoid becoming free-floating silhouettes, and floated slowly along the length of the vessel. They had orders to transfer to a wall before they got to the nose area, just in case sensors were still active. We thought the Boojums were probably in maintenance mode at this point, but best not to tempt fate. In the end, we were depending on the complete lack of curiosity and total single-minded focus on the task at hand that typified every AMI in existence, as far as we knew. The gamers in charge of flying the drones were frame-jacked high enough to be able to take the time to consider their actions and the possible consequences, but that also meant I'd have to jack if I wanted to communicate with them. Constant disassembly and reassembly of my VR would be too disconcerting. I decided to just remain a spectator. We could compare notes later. Soon the drones were positioned in a small alcove created by the intersection of an airlock area and two support columns. SUDAR scans had indicated that this would be out of line of sight for most of the bay. There were a number of cameras and sensors in evidence, but without tracing the circuitry, there was no way to know which ones might be surveillance of some kind and which ones were strictly operational. We had already decided not to worry about it. There was no way to make this op completely safe, so we would learn from our failures and try again, if necessary. The drones waited for a break in activity, then scooted to the next rally point, a dead area between two different types of docking racks. They whipped around the last corner into the alcove and almost ran right smack into a maintenance bot. "What the hell?" Bill exclaimed. I jacked immediately, VR be damned. "Anyone have any idea what that thing is doing here?" I said to the drone operators in general. At this clock speed, they were represented only by their metadata tags, hanging in a virtual void. One of the tags, labeled Randall, replied, "No, and it wasn't on the planning scans. There's nothing here. It's just a gap in the..." "Oh." A window popped up and spun around for all to see. "Looks like a bulkhead repair in progress." "Friggin' hell," I muttered. "It's times like this that I'm glad I don't have an actual heart to have a heart attack with." I returned to regular Bob time, reassembled my VR, and turned to Bill, who was just moving his lips to begin whatever next sentence he had in mind. I cut in before he could get properly going. "It's doing bulkhead repairs, complete coincidence, and we're above its sensor area, so it probably hasn't noticed us." "Peachy," Bill replied. "No alarms so far anyway, we might just pull this off." It took several more hops by the drones, but there were no more coronary-inducing events. The drones found themselves in front of an access panel. According to our scans, this would lead to what some wit had called a Jeffries tube. In theory, it should get us to the acceleration track used by the mechanism that connected the non-rotating outer shell to the rotating inner shell of the megastructure, but from that point on, there would be more winging it involved, as not all the engineering control systems could be resolved in detail. One of the drones released some roamers which popped out customized screwdrivers and attacked the attachment points on the panel. I had a moment of I don't know, deja vu? Nostalgia? Something like that, as I noticed that the Snarks used a screw head virtually identical to a Robertson. I guess some geometry problems are universal. The roamers couldn't reseal the hatch properly from the inside, so once all our units had entered, the roamers pulled the hatch closed and performed a small spot weld. It wouldn't hold against any kind of assault, but the point was for things to appear normal, not for us to fortify our rear. Job complete, the roamers climbed back into the drone, and we continued on. We couldn't wait around to catch a ride on the rail system, since there seemed to be no rides to catch. We certainly couldn't activate the system on our own, and even if we could figure out how to do that, it would probably attract unwelcome attention. That seemed like the kind of system that would require some high-level management involvement, if only for approvals and scheduling. That left us with the strategy of scurrying around the innards like rodents, trying to make our way to the inside of the megastructure, which was easier than you'd think. Rodents had been finding pathways through everything humans had built for millennia. One advantage of the containers all being parked was that the ring was empty, like an elevator shaft, with no elevator. And the drones had sufficient acceleration to be able to match up with the inner shell while following a circular path, so we would be able to dock on the inner shell receiving station. It took several hours of preparation, mapping out small spaces and dodging maintenance bots, but we eventually found ourselves ready for the big step, flying from the stationary outer shell to the rotating inner shell. We decided to try out the strategy with one single drone before risking the entire squadron. There was some initial wobbling until Gandalf got the hang of it, then the drone's path smoothed out. The drone landed on a small maintenance platform in what I suppose I'd call the station or terminal on the inner shell that was supposed to give the inhabitants of the Topopolis access to the elevator system. I could see where the elevator containers would meet up with a pressure door, allowing passengers to go from a pressurized elevator cabin to a pressurized megastructure interior. Up to this point, we'd been operating in vacuum. Now, we'd have to figure out how to get into a shirt-sleeve environment, again, without setting off any alarms. Once the entire squadron arrived, the next step was intelligence gathering. A couple of drones ejected roamers, which swarmed over the hatch system. In about 10 minutes, we had a report.
"Well, the good news is that the systems are well designed," Gandalf said. "That means they have manual overrides in case something goes wrong."
"And the bad news?" I asked.
"The manual overrides have what I expect are alarm sensors, so as soon as we use them, management will know."
"So
we'll gimmick the sensors. If the door-opened sensor doesn't trip, no one will be the wiser."
"That could take a while."
"Yep. And some of those sensors are on the other side of bulkheads, so we have to drill through to get to them. We'll send in the 2-millimeter roamers."
"And this won't set off any alarms?" Gandalf shook his head.
"This isn't a top-secret military base. They wouldn't expect anyone to be trying to break in like this, so why would they engineer for it?"
That seemed like dubious logic, or wishful thinking. "Confidence level?"
"We scanned it, Bob. There's just the one level of sensor security."
I nodded, satisfied for the moment. But if alarms went off, heads would be slapped. "Think about the scale, Bob," Bill added, sidling up to me. "A billion miles of megastructure with doors, airlocks, passageways, restricted areas. How would you police that?" "You have to set up automated processes and trust those processes to bump alerts upstream. You want to avoid redundant signals as well to keep the overall processing down."
"So kill the alerts at source and nothing happens."
"Yep,"
Gandalf said, looking up from his monitor. I'll give the gamers their due. They were careful and methodical. It took almost half a day to defang the airlock to the point where it could be used without bringing Armageddon down on us. Finally, Gandalf gave the thumbs up and we began manually cycling our devices through. At one point, I had a thought and snorted. It would be a hell of a thing if you got this far only to discover that the drones couldn't fit through the airlock.
It would indeed, Gandalf replied with a smirk. Which is why we checked for that during the planning stages. That is why you pay us the big bucks. Assuming I paid you any bucks. A valid point, he grinned at me, then turned back to his monitor. And this is the last load. Next stop, megastructure interior. Once past the airlock, our drones found themselves in a corridor leading from the spin transfer system into, presumably, the main part of the station. I spent some time examining the corridor. There wasn't much to see. Low-level lighting illuminated the area, and I could see what appeared to be traditional elevator doors at the other end. Unless you were shaped like a Krell, there were only so many ways to design corridors and doors, so it wouldn't have looked out of place in a human-based installation. Even the writing. Apparently the need to label every damned thing was another universal. Although I couldn't read any of it, I amused myself for a few moments by imagining snark exhortations to not injure one's limbs by sticking them in the crushy, grindy place, and other legally mandated warnings for idiots. The elevators were reminiscent of any random office building on Earth. There was also, because the snarks had some version of building codes, a set of emergency stairs. The stairs might or might not be alarmed, and the elevators might or might not alert someone when used. I hoped the gamers had taken those possibilities into account. Elevators aren't alarmed?
Don't know, Gandalf replied. Same problem as with the intershell rail system. We can't tell where the signals go. But the stairs don't have door sensors.
I grunted, but otherwise didn't respond. It wasn't me climbing the stairs, after all. This part of the operation turned out to be fairly tedious, like trekking through a dungeon that was all corridor. Of course, something could always jump out of a hidden alcove, which made for a strange combination of stress and boredom. We passed doors to several other levels on the way up, but finally all the drones were at the top of the stairs. As Gandalf described it, the door opened into the foyer of the transit station on the inside surface of the megastructure. In better times, this was where the inhabitants would have come to travel to the outer shell and then outside the Topopolis. There was some indication in the scans that this was also a transit stop for some kind of internal transit system. Unfortunately, there were only so many milliseconds in a day, and that investigation had been backburnered.
So, here's where it gets complicated, Gandalf said.
And what have we been doing up till now? I asked.
Two problems.
Gandalf brought up some subsidiary windows to illustrate.
First, the foyer has cameras. Second, there are sensors on the external doors. Third, if management wanted to keep the natives out of the station, this is where the security would be concentrated, both inside and outside. So, we can't use the front door.
I assume you have an alternative? He grinned at me.
Big bucks, remember? We're going to tunnel out.
Tunnel? Like the Great Escape?
Well, it's not like we haven't been cutting into things right and left, and the snarks use that weird ceramic carbon fiber material everywhere that we'd use concrete on Earth, which works out for us since it yields to a plasma cutter with very little argument.
So after all this high-tech spy stuff, we're going to dig our way out like rats.
You gotta know when to go low-tech, Bob.
Garfield pulled up a schematic of the station and pointed to a spot.
Here. This will come out just under ground level so we can cover it up once we're through.
Outside surveillance?
That's not a problem. There are cameras covering the entrance, but not so much the back and sides.
Then let's do this.
Cutting through the wall, then digging up to ground level was tedious, but mostly uneventful. We surprised a representative of the local wildlife when the roamer popped out of the ground. The animal, some kind of deer analog, I think, jumped straight back about 10 feet, then bounded away with a panicked bleating.
Time to start spying, Gandalf said.
He sent a command to the drones, and several of them popped open their cargo doors. Out came little spy drones, a combination of tech from my spying on the Deltons and Jock's spying on the PAV. Improvements in technology, including but not limited to the Casimir power sources, meant that the modern version of the spy drone was no bigger than a sparrow. Add in the camouflage system, and we were confident we'd avoid discovery by the natives.
These drones would, among other tasks, try to supplement the Skippy's scans with some good old-fashioned eavesdropping. Discovery by the mysterious Topopolis controller was another thing to consider. It was a safe bet that the habitat included surveillance of some kind, if only to watch for maintenance issues. Add to that the fact that the natives were actively kept to a largely pre-industrial level, which could necessitate some kind of surveillance system anyway. How the technology limits would be enforced was an important question. We didn't want to accidentally get caught in a purge of some kind.
Spy drones are on their way, Garfield commented. Now we wait.
12. Expedition Prep. Bob, November 2333, outskirts Eta Leporis. The spy drones had multiple duties, so they'd be busy for a while. In addition to finding a way to eavesdrop on the snarks and learn their language, the drones would be doing biological surveys and surveys of the towns and infrastructure. The drones had been given a search algorithm by the Skippies, which, according to them, would help to gather the required raw data in a more efficient manner. I didn't necessarily distrust them, but I'd nevertheless rigged a hardware monitor into the drones. It would be completely undetectable unless you knew the access protocols and keys. Bill's paranoia seemed to have colored my experiences with the Bobiverse in general. There was plenty to do, meanwhile. We had enough basic info to start on fabbing an alpha version of the Snark Mannies. Details could be filled in once the Skippies finished their biological survey. And there was still the question of getting Bridget involved, at least for consulting on the Snark biology. I was working on the Manny design when I got a ping from Bridget. She and I didn't hang around together, so this was unlikely to be just out of the blue. I suspected someone might have said something to someone. I sent an accept, and a moment later she popped in. Bridget spent a few mils looking around at my library.
I very much approve. Howard had a library motif for a while, but never this many books. Are they real?
All of them, right down to content, I said. I've raided every human database I can find. BobNet contains the sum of human and PAV written knowledge.
Well, it's great to have a hobby.
Bridget hesitated, then launched right into what she was really here for.
Bob, I'd like a position on the Snark exploration op when it's ready.
Okay.
I mean, I'm a biologist, and I have lots of wait, what?
I grinned at her. Honestly, I was trying to figure out how to bring it up. I was planning to take the coward's way out and talk to Howard.
I am simultaneously offended and gratified, she replied. Still, results are what count. I see you're working on Manny's. How much work to do a female version?
Ah. Snark sexual dimorphism is minimal. Females have a slightly larger head, but it's probably mostly about pheromones, so not much.
Good. Bill tells me you have the Skippies doing the survey. You trust them?
I raised an eyebrow at that comment. My earlier conversation with Bill about the subject was an intra-Bob kind of thing. To have a third party concerned about the Bob variants put a whole new level of significance on the problem. Why in particular do you ask, Bridget?
Oh, they haven't started chanting one of us, or something equally nefarious. It's just that they really aren't Bobs anymore. It would be less unsettling if they changed their appearance like the Borg cosplayers, but they still look like Howard, or a pod person version of him.
You've watched Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Bob, I'm married to Howard. What do you suppose we watch on movie nights, Wuthering Heights?
I laughed and she smiled in return, and I was reminded once again what Howard saw in her, among many other things. I shook off the moment with some effort and changed the subject. The Skippies originally figured a couple of weeks at most to get a complete picture of the local snark culture, which we are almost at the end of. We all acknowledge that there may be regional differences with over a billion miles of potential spread, but we'll deal with that, if and when.
Accents, or even different languages, cultural drift, nationalism, I get it. Depends how long they've been cooped up in there, too. Not long, Bill popped in at that moment. Bridget, hey! Has Bob managed to convince you to come on the expedition?
Bridget gave me a smile and an eye roll, then replied to Bill.
Yes, he has. Took a lot of work.
Horse pucky.
Bridget laughed, then turned back to me. You were saying?
Oh, based on our survey of the Snark's home planet, residual radioactivity and number of forest fire tracks, we figure it became unlivable somewhere around a few hundred years ago. I'm not sure what that means in Snark generations.
Bridget nodded and glanced at Bill. It occurred to me that Bill was here for something, so I tilted my head at him in a silent invitation to speak.
Right, Bill said. I came here for something. The Skippies delivered a preliminary report, mostly ecosystems and general survey. They're still having a slow go of it on the language and cultural stuff, although they did give me a couple of things. The natives call themselves Quinlans. At least that's the closest phonetic rendition. And the Topopolis is called Heaven's River.
Cool. Okay, then. The Snarks are now officially Quinlans.
Have they compiled a detailed report on biology?
Bridget asked.
Hugh gave me some general notes and said he'll have a formal report for us within 48 hours.
Hugh?
Bridget asked.
I thought the Skippies all used numeric designations.
I guess there's still some Bob there, because they're pretty easygoing about it. They'll use nicknames when dealing with the rest of us.
I turned to Bill. Have you talked to Will yet?
Yep, he's okay with the plan, so me, you, Garfield, and Bridget, with Will as backup.
Good. I'll ping everyone when I get the final report, and we'll meet here and discuss it.
Will was the last to show up. Bridget raised her coffee cup and saluted as he popped in. That was a habit she'd picked up from me. Well, from Howard. I had it on good authority, though, that her coffee was espresso level plus and would dissolve any spoon unlucky enough to be dunked therein. Will parked himself in a beanbag chair that I'd materialized for him, accepted a Coke from Jeeves, and motioned to me with one hand.
So here it is, I said, waving a sheaf of paper. The report wasn't actually on paper, but it made a good metaphor invert. Megastructure layout, ecology, Quinlan culture, language, both written and verbal, customs and taboos, and very little history.
What? Why?
Hugh reluctantly admitted the Skippy group that worked on this wasn't sure. He looked like the admission gave him constipation. But the Quinlans just don't seem to talk about it much, and what they do talk about seems to be heavily mythologized. The library they checked out had nothing in the way of objective historical records, so we're still in the dark about that. One more good reason for the expedition. Bridget looked up from her copy of the report, which she was perusing on a tablet metaphor.
The Quinlans appear to be a species that evolved on the banks of rivers, like river otters or beavers,
both of which they resemble, I interjected.
Yes, with a little bit of platypus thrown in, Bridget said with a smile. But all their habitations are close to water. Either the main rivers, tributaries, feeder rivers, or small lakes. All freshwater, too. I'm not sure how the megastructure maintains that. There must be filtering going on.
There are impellers of some kind set periodically along the bottom of the river, Bill said. That's an efficient way to keep current flowing along a billion-mile-long river that's actually level the whole way. They might also perform a filtering function as well as turning over the water.
We have some information on local flora and fauna, farming and animal husbandry, and so on, Bridget said. Sociological stuff is almost non-existent.
I think the Skippies might have skimped on that aspect a little, I grinned. Not very interesting.
So it'll be a learning experience. That's fine.
Bridget sat back and tossed her tablet on a side table. It bounced as if made of Nerf.
Now, about the androids.
Ah, yes, I think you'll be pleased.
I vanished the report and popped up a schematic in the center of the group, then gestured to Bill to take the floor. Android tech has been improving steadily, thanks to its popularity and a lot of feedback from you and Howard. Bill nodded to Bridget. I think your current Manny's back on Quilt might be a couple of generations behind the bleeding edge, though. A Quinlan form materialized beside the generic android schematic. The latest Manny's no longer contain any metal at all. Circuitry, even the SCUT interface, is all quantum bionics and metamaterials,
We've gone to great lengths to make the density of the internals similar to biophysique, so Manny's are no longer ludicrously heavy for their size. And we've introduced a circulatory system that contains fluid indistinguishable from blood. It acts as lubricant, coolant, and transport for repair nanites. We even have digestive systems that will convert food into quite believable waste products. Just can't resist the potty jokes, can you? Will grinned at him. You bet, number two. Garfield, Will, and I laughed while Bridget rolled her eyes and shook her head. Still not very mature. Nope. Now, we're maybe up to the beta version of a Quinlan Manny, Bill continued. Translator interface is still in development, and a lot of the reflexes are probably not realistic. Bridget, we'll need your help to refine that. Space is tight because we are trying to build as much self-repair capability as possible into the units. If something goes wrong in-country, you won't be able to just take it into the shop for repairs. Bridget nodded, her gaze glued to the schematic and supporting windows.
How is it with heat dissipation?
Yeah, not great. With the fur and the short, dumpy profile. A human Manny can run full speed all day. A Quinlan Manny will have to stop and cool down. Although in water, they will probably be okay.
Well, we are entering new territory, aren't we?
Bridget replied with a smile.
I think I'll talk to Marcus, though. He's probably the expert on non-humanoid Mannies these days. Bob, I have a concern, Bridget said to me a few moments later.
The others had already popped out, and it seemed she'd been waiting to talk to me alone.
Okay. This expedition is looking like it could be a long-term thing.
Well, yeah, it's pretty much open-ended. We're not just doing research, we're also looking for Bender, or at least some indication of what happened to him.
We have to stay with our Mannies full-time, except when sleeping, right?
Yes, but you can pop out during the sleep cycle, or even just frame-jack for a moment to take care of something. I went years on Eden and never had a problem.
But you don't have children. My kids are human. I have to deal with them in real time and on a human schedule. Plus, there was that movie with the tall blue aliens.
Avatar?
That's it. Remember the main character left his avatar sleeping and it almost got run over before he could get back to it?
Oh, yeah. Kind of a downside, I guess. Bridget dropped her gaze, silent for a mill, then sighed.
I guess I have three choices. I can drop out, and I'd never forgive myself. I can simply bite the bullet and go into this full time and do short visits with Howard and the kids when the opportunity presents, or I can...
She took on a pained expression.
Replicate.
Whoa. A Bridget clone? You'd be the first non-Bob to do so. The pained expression grew cloudier.
Well, I'm not particularly concerned about firsts. Not in that way, anyway. The thing is...
She hesitated again. Other Bobs?
Yes. Especially the later ones. It feels sometimes that there's this expectation that I should replicate and be everyone's girlfriend. It doesn't work that way.
I know, Bridge. And I'm sure the other replicants do as well, at least on an intellectual level. But they see you with Howard and, you know, the train of thought is hard to resist.
But Howard is not just another Bob. He's unique. And our experiences together are unique.
Yeah, I know, but original Bob, for all his intelligence, was not all that emotionally self-aware, and the model hasn't improved over time. I cringed inwardly, thinking of some of the things I'd learned the hard way about myself back on Eden.
I get it. And I haven't actually been approached or anything, but... If I do replicate myself for this expedition, it might be like the floodgates opening in terms of expectation.
Understood. I'll help out any way I can, as will Bill and Garfield, but it's your decision. We'll accept whatever you decide, and we could probably get Will to take your place with minimal convincing, although he might have an objection to a female Manny if you wait until we've already built the units.
Well, there's a rumor,
still unverified... I grinned at her. And they'd have to be really late generation. Original Bob had no uncertainties about his gender. She laughed.
It would be pretty cool, though, to have another woman in here.
Then she turned somber.
I'll think about it and let you know, Bob. Sorry for the headache.
I had never been to a moot quite this raucous. Officially, the subject under discussion was the Heaven's River expedition, planning for. In reality, Starfleet had come to the moot loaded for bear. They consistently torpedoed any attempt at discussion with points of order and derails of various kinds. Bill showed a lot more patience than I thought a Bob was capable of. I was sure I'd have lost it by now. They were actually wearing something that was close to but not quite TNG command uniforms. I guess they wanted to make the point without being out and out laughable. A lot of Bobs seemed to think they'd failed on that last bit, judging from the derisive comments. At the moment, a red-uniformed officer was spouting off. You don't know if they purposely decided on this life. That's the point. You're going in, you claim, to see if they're captives, but you'll do the damage before you know if it's necessary, assuming it's necessary. Starfleet paused to take a breath, totally unnecessary in the Bobiverse, but a habit ingrained through 31 years as a human, and Bill took the opportunity to jump in.
And you're assuming prima facie that we'll be doing damage. Of course you are, because you consider interacting with them to be damage.
Then you point to the interaction as proof of the damage. Circular argument. No Cupid doll, sorry. We have a responsibility, argument by assertion, to keep from interfering in the affairs, prejudicial language, and you haven't proven the assertion yet. Starfleet gave Bill a murderous glare, and another red-suited member took up the attack. Look at your history. Deltans, others, even humanity. Every time you interact, you cause damage. Others? You're using the others as an example? Bill's expression of bristling disbelief was probably at least partly acting, but if there was ever a justification, this was it. The others weren't just sitting around minding their own business, you know? The damage they were doing. There's always a rationalization, isn't there? I stopped listening. Sadly, it was like most political arguments. No one was willing to debate their base assumptions or justify them or compromise on them. The simple tactic being that if you repeated your assertion often enough with enough emotion and volume, the opponents would somehow be forced to see things your way. Never worked, of course. At least it never had with original Bob, but that didn't stop people from trying. Even Bob's, apparently.
I scanned the audience idly while waiting for Starfleet to get tired of beating their collective head against a brick wall, and was surprised to see two unfamiliar faces.
I tried to check metadata, but I was blocked, so I sent a low-priority text to Bill. He responded during Starfleet's next tirade, evidently not listening any more than I was. Couple of replicants, clients of Eternity Solutions from Asgard. That was interesting. The people who chose a replicant afterlife were buying into strata-tidal virtual reality systems, computer systems orbiting in the Oort in their local system, rather than setting themselves up with a spaceship. From what I understood, you could purchase different packages which got you access to different levels of computer power, different VR options, and even access to Manny's for physical interfacing in real. They had access to BobNet as well, as did anyone, but mostly they'd kept to themselves. We had security policies set up, of course. They were guests in the computer sense of the word as well as the social sense, but Bill had an open-door policy regarding the moots. If anyone wanted to visit or even play some baseball, that was fine. The woman appeared bored. The man was trying to look in every direction at once, totally overwhelmed by the experience. It was obvious who had brought whom to the moot. They weren't making any waves with the Bobs either. Not like when Bridget or Henry first joined the moot. It must have become at least somewhat commonplace. I brought my attention back to the argument when the currently speaking Starfleet rep abruptly made a cutting-off gesture and said, "Enough! This is pointless. I can see you're not going to do the right thing on your own, so be it." He nodded to his group, and as one, they winked out. The moot erupted into pandemonium, more than before, I mean. "That," I said to Bill in a low voice, "was a veiled threat." "Yeah, but what exactly?" He frowned.
Well, maybe we can get this meeting done now, and you and I will have to discuss this later.
Hugh was sending updates every 24 hours. For all that made the Skippies weird on paper, they were a lot more civilized and courteous than Starfleet, whom you'd think would be almost mainstream in the Bobiverse. Language and customs were coming along, finally. We seemed to have crossed some kind of cusp, where blocks of disparate information began coalescing into a more complete picture. We could actually go in with what we had at this point, in an emergency. We'd just pretend to be from far away, and in Heaven's River, far away really meant something. The Borg had finished their android design based on the complete report on biology and had given me an autofactory blueprint for one generic native Quinlan, male or female, with editable parameters suitable for producing distinct, individualized units. According to the notes, Quinlans differentiated each other primarily by facial shape and features, just like humans, plus some color variations in facial fur. The complete package included software and hardware support for generating unique faces. The notes also stressed that some field testing would be required before the design could be considered ready. It was funny. For all the divergence of the Bobs, give them a problem to solve, and the differences disappeared. I would be very sad when I met a clone that lacked that quality. That would no longer be Robert Johansson in any sense that mattered. The exploration crew, including Will, was due for a meeting at 1600 to go over our status, so I was a little surprised to get a ping from Bridget 5 minutes early. I invited her over, and she popped in right away. "Hi, Bridget." I gestured to her favorite chair, and she dropped into it, looking uncharacteristically unsure of herself.
"That thing we were talking about earlier?"
she said, and waited for me to nod.
"I'm not going to clone."
I waited for Bridget to continue, but it looked like she was waiting for me to comment.
"Okay.
You've discussed it with Howard?" She nodded.
"He's not happy. Mostly because I'm not happy. I mean, he's happy I won't be cloning, but
I know what you mean.
I have to be honest, Bridge, I don't entirely understand why you and Henry are so much against replication. I mean, I've never been what you call a fan, but we are heading for 10,000 Bobs by now.
Many of whom don't self-identify as Bob clones anymore."
Bridget waved off my incipient reply.
"I know that's not relevant to your decision, but it is relevant to ours. Plus, your being a humanist helps. You don't see yourself as being any more or less Bob than original Bob or any of your clones. For someone with, a more metaphysical view of life, it's not that simple. The best I can describe it is that I feel like each of us, myself and my clone, would end up with half a soul."
I opened my mouth to point out that technically, by her belief system, only original Bridget had the soul, but realized in time that that would be the exact opposite of reassuring. Maybe I was finally learning when to keep my cake hole shut.
"And on a more personal basis," she continued, "the new Bridget would be cut off from Howard and from our children. I know I wouldn't be able to share them with her, and Howard told me flat out that he'd be completely weirded out by the idea. I try to imagine myself waking up and realizing that I'm the copy, that I'll never again be with Howard and the kids."
Her lips quivered as she struggled to regain control. I waited quietly, giving her as much time as she needed. Finally, she said,
"I couldn't do that to myself, or to other me. So I'm going to accept that I'll be working away from home for a while. And I'll make it up to them when I'm done."
"Okay, Bridget. Either way, it's good to have you on the team."
She flashed what Howard referred to as one of her nuclear smiles, and I felt my IQ drop. Fortunately, Bill and Garfield picked that moment to pop in.
"Hey, all, got the latest from Hugh." Bill waved a bound report at us as he threw himself into his chair.
Garfield settled in with a little more dignity. I summoned Jeeves, who brought in coffee, little sandwiches without crusts, and a perpetually full and fizzy glass of Coke for Will when he showed up. Bill held up one of the sandwiches.
"You've served these a couple of times now. I like them, but where did the idea come from?"
I grabbed a sandwich and scrutinized it.
"Dunno.
random memory from original Bob, I guess. I'll probably get tired of them eventually, but you can put a lot of different things in sandwiches. Will popped in, waved, and flopped into his beanbag.
Okay, ladies and germs, let's do this. Bill grinned at him and tossed the report into the air. It morphed into a video window, and Bill waggled a finger to pull up summaries and sub-windows.
Androids are coming along. It'll be a good 6 months yet before they're ready, assuming they pass all functional tests. We're working with a lot of new techniques here, so I don't want to rush anything. Bill motioned to Garfield, who took up the thread.
The gamers went through a ton of scenarios but couldn't come up with anything tricky that would get four Quinlan-sized bodies through the airlock and past the Boojums, so they've suggested we just bore through the outer shell, then work our way into the elevator system internally.
That seems risky. What if the Boojums notice?
Well, the gamers suggested that the Boojums can't be too hair-trigger about the outer shell. After all, even with the amount of in-system cleanup they've done, there will still be a certain number of micrometeor impacts every year. If they came running each time there was a tremor, they'd be doing nothing else.
Good point. I cocked my head. Are we going to test it?
I figure we'll just pick a point between two airlocks and start digging. If they come running, we either run away or self-destruct, then come up with another plan.
Will grinned. Well, it does have the virtue of simplicity.
Yeah, I rubbed my eyes.
All right, let's give it a try. Gar, can you be in charge of implementation?
Sure thing.
Next order of business, I said. What do we do when we get in?
Damned if I know, Bill answered.
We have absolutely no indication that Bender is even in Heaven's River, let alone where he might be. This makes a needle in a haystack look like a sure thing.
Except we don't really need to find Bender, Garfield interjected. Heads turned to him. All we need to do is establish contact with whoever has him. Or failing that, with whoever runs the ship, assuming they're not the same group. This isn't a blind search. It's more like detective work.
True enough, we'll be working blind initially.
I was silent for a moment as I went through the options.
As we learn more, we can narrow things down a little, maybe get more of a sense of direction, metaphorically speaking. There were nods around the circle as each person worked through the implications.
This was the open-ended aspect of the project. We had no idea how long it might take to narrow things down because we had very little idea what we were going to find.
It's worth noting, Garfield said into the silence, that there aren't that many Boojum airlocks. If you assume that Bender's matrix went in through one of them, it really narrows things down.
True, there are, what, 9 entrances?
Yes. And most of them appear to be inactive, which makes sense if they aren't doing anything beyond cleanup patrols.
Could we send in multiple teams?
Bridget asked.
Bill shook his head.
We talked about that. More teams would mean more delay and more likelihood of exposure. Once the Topopolis controllers discover our existence, they'd likely institute some kind of large-scale search and maybe take other defensive postures. Remember, we don't know that they'll be friendly. Our only contact with them so far has been them blowing up Bender and then Bob's drones. I don't want to take a chance on how they might react to an invading force.
Keep it small. Don't look dangerous.
He grinned at us.
Having said that, if we run into a brick wall, there's always the option of sending more teams in. Bob can build some more matrixes locally and do some cloning, if bandwidth starts to become an issue.
But the Mannies take a lot of time to build, very finicky design.
The spy drones will continue to spread out as well, Will added, in both directions, upstream and downstream. If they find anything unusual, we'll be alerted, and we can make a beeline for that location.
We all exchanged looks.
I guess we're on track, I said. Let's see how the tunneling works out, then we'll meet and discuss.
13. Swimming with the Fish.
Howard, December 2333. Big Top, Epsilon Eridani, Poseidon, Eta Cassiopeiae.
Another beautiful day in Tantor.
Hands behind my back, I gazed through the picture window at the layers of cloud outside the city dome. At our altitude in the atmosphere of the Jovian planet Big Top, I could see at least 50 miles of clouds above us,
and anywhere up to 100 downward before the view faded into the mist.
They renamed it Tranter. After all your carping, Howard, you got your way. Stop being a sore winner.
I could feel Bridget's glare boring holes in the back of my head. She was right, of course, but what was the point of being a curmudgeon if you couldn't curmudge? I turned and walked over behind her. I kissed the back of her head, and she leaned into me. This gave me an opportunity to examine the image on the canvas. More new quilt species? Bridget pointed to several items.
Sure looks like it. I can't figure out the mechanism, but quilt biota can and often do spawn new species every few generations. I shelved this for 5 years, and I'm basically starting over from scratch.
She swiped the canvas with an irritated motion, and the screen winked out of existence. If you go on this expedition with Bob, it could be another several years. You might never catch up. It wasn't quite an objection, but it wasn't supportive either. I still hadn't decided if I was for or against Bridget going.
I know, Howard, but Quilt will still be there. This is a once-only opportunity. Did you contact Marcus?
Yep. He's agreed to give us a tour. He'll be waiting at Moody Port. We should pop over in Vert first to say hi.
Then let's do this.
The Manny Closet opened at my mental command, and we stepped into our individual pods. As the pods started to close, I took a quick glance at Bridget. Her resting face showed she was more concerned than she let on. I knew this decision would be hard. I also knew she'd agree to do it. There were few people as driven as my wife. I exited the Manny and popped over to Marcus's VR. A moment later, Bridget appeared. Marcus, sitting by a fireplace, waved to a couch. Coffee and snacks sat on a coffee table within easy reach. Marcus was using the standard Bob Library VR at the moment, probably taking a rest from the Battlestar themes. He waited until we were comfortable and properly snacked, then said,
"So, I understand your inquiry has to do with the business that Bob One is involved with, but I haven't really been following it. Mind filling me in?"
"We'll be going into the megastructure wearing manis that mimic the native sophons."
Bridget shifted and leaned forward, gesturing with her hands.
"That part isn't new. Bob One did it with the Deltons, and Howard and I have done it. We've even done non-humanoid manis, as with the big top native species."
Bridget glanced sideways at me, and I grinned. Flying around in the gas giant's atmosphere as humongous manta rays was one of our first adventures as a replicant couple, and we still did it occasionally for fun. Bridget continued,
"The natives are generally humanoid, but they're also aquatic, and they're intelligent, and come from a technological society, although we're not sure of their current level of knowledge. From that point of view, it's a bit of an unknown. We were hoping you could give us some perspective on aquatic manis."
Marcus nodded and looked thoughtful for a fraction of a mil.
"The Poseidon dolphins are intelligent animals, but as far as we can tell, they're animals, just like Terran dolphins were. There's a simple language, but it's at the level of danger, predator, and good food. There's no symbology or grammatical structure. It's only slightly more advanced than baboon calls. So I'm not sure where I come in."
"You've been living among them almost full time for a couple of years, though,"
Bridget replied.
"How well are you accepted? How long did it take to fit in? And how hard is it to act like a dolphin?"
"I get the impression they think I'm a little weird."
Marcus shrugged and gave an embarrassed smile. "But I'm not shunned. I've had to fend off some mating advances, so I'm not too weird, you know."
"Hasn't stopped me," I interjected.
Bridget made a low growling sound as Marcus laughed.
"I think it sounds like you're concerned about fitting in without issue. That just requires doing your homework first. As for the aquatic end of things," Marcus shrugged. "Well, let's find out. I have a couple of spare dolphin manis."
Marcus messaged us a couple of addresses, then popped out. I followed immediately and found myself lying on my stomach on a platform in a dark room. Wait, no, it wasn't a dark room. It was underwater. I rolled my eyes upward as I examined my action inventory and saw that we were about 10 feet below the surface on the edge of what was probably one of the Poseidon plant mats. This would be Moody Port, formerly a major colony location on the West Indies mat.
Nowadays, with everyone living in flying cities, it was strictly for agriculture and aquaculture. To my left, two other dolphin mannies were moving around. A quick ping identified Bridget furthest left and Marcus to her right. My heads-up help system indicated that the dolphins used a swim bladder to control buoyancy. I flexed and felt myself float up off the platform. A quick flick of the tail, and I was sliding forward through the water. Original Bob had never been much of a swimmer, preferring to keep water in bathtubs and, in extreme situations, hot tubs. But this was different. More like flying. The big difference seemed to be the complete lack of any concern about drowning. Of course, in a manny, breathing wasn't a problem anyway, but the Poseidon dolphins actually were fish, so they absorbed oxygen from the water using something like gills. Interestingly, they could also absorb oxygen from the air while floating at the surface by pumping air slowly through their swim bladder, so holding one's breath would never be an issue. It was kind of a best-of-both-worlds thing. The resemblance to Earth dolphins was remarkable, though. The domed heads and beaked mouths could fool you into thinking you were dealing with Earth stock until you spotted the vertical tail flukes. Bridget shot past me, then glided to a gradual stop. She turned and repeated her actions. Marcus bumped me, then spoke over the universal intercom. She's very methodical, testing maneuvers one at a time. You have no idea. Hey, Bridget said, I'm swimming here. There's a pod that hangs around this area because of the spillover from some of the aquaculture. I figure we'll go join them for a while, and you can see what it's like to swim with the natives. Marcus swam off, clearly knowing where he was going. I glanced at Bridget, and we turned to follow. Over the next few minutes, Marcus gradually increased his pace. I had a brief bit of trouble at one point, sort of like when you change from a jog to a sprint, and I couldn't get the new rhythm, but by letting go and allowing the autonomous systems to take over, I was able to correct. After that, I kept up with Marcus with no effort. We're going just about flat out for a dolphin, he said. We'll have to slow down before we get to the pod, or they'll think we're running from something. We don't want to start a mobbing.
That's not part of the autonomous systems, though, right?
Bridget asked.
Correct. There are some things you just have to learn through study, Marcus replied.
How's your swimming?
Fine, thanks. I feel a lot less concerned about that aspect of things. The manny system seemed to be highly competent at mimicking natural reflexes.
Marcus didn't reply, but he did an exuberant barrel roll. I did a barrel roll of my own, then found I'd overshot and had to complete a second one. Some things apparently did require practice. Marcus slowed down and began taking a more circular path. Probably we were getting close to the pod, and he didn't want to charge straight at them.